Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Jeff's rugby team will depart in 5 minutes from platform 15. Your ride comes with 6 toilets and a refreshments carriage that you'll empty within 5 minutes. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
They say go big or go home. But now you can go big at home with the Big Arch on delivery. When you're hungry for something big, like really big, Big Arch for big McDonald's hunger. Order on the McDonald's app. Saved from 11 a.m. Upcharges and fees apply to delivery orders. Subject to availability. Price and participation may vary.
Hey, welcome back to the Immigrantly Hive. I am your host, Sadia Khan. Okay, I need to tell you something about me. I like museums that are small and cozy. The kind where you can actually breathe. Huge places like the Met in New York City, they give me so much anxiety. I walk in and immediately freeze. Where do I even start? What do I see? What do I skip? What do I save for a next trip that, let's be honest, may never happen? But realistically, the size is not even my biggest issue with museums in the West. There's something else that sits with me, this colonial vibe. It's in the way artifacts from the Global South are presented, the lighting, the labels, the language. A sacred object from, say, a temple in Tamil Nadu, described by someone who's never set foot in Tamil Nadu. A piece of Indus Valley history categorized by an archaeologist whose government was occupying the Indus Valley at the time they dug it up. And then there's this question I can't stop turning over in my mind. Should these objects even be here? Should an artifact from India, Pakistan, Egypt, excavated, taken, shipped across oceans, be sitting in a museum in New York or Washington, D.C.? Is that preservation or is it something else? Today, I'm sitting down with someone who works inside the system. And I mean inside. She is the head of public programs at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Asian Art. Nicole Dowd has a front row seat to all of these questions. And her museum has actually started doing something about them. We are going to get into all of it. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Hi, Nicole. How are you doing?
Hi. It's really, really great to meet you. I'm doing well. How are you?
I am good. I was looking at your Instagram. Not that I was stalking you, but I saw you're a mountain climber, right?
Oh, yeah. I do some rock climbing and definitely, you know, some traveling to climb outside and hiking. You know, it really helps, I think, with my mental health to do something that is so completely opposite of my 9-to-5, of my job, and just really gets me outside. And it's something I just took up right before the pandemic and then realized that I was super, super hooked on it.
So is it a collective sport or is it like more an isolated individual sport? Do you get to meet other people? How does it work?
You know, I think it depends on what you're looking for. I started climbing with my husband as my partner. And so it is something that we do a lot together. And we travel together to look at new climbing destinations that we want to go to. But we do have some friends that also climb. And in DC, there's not really a lot of outdoor spaces to go to. So we spend a lot of time at the climbing gym. And that's also like a good place to meet people. It's kind of a fun sport because there are forms of climbing that you can do by yourself. And that's also, you know, just a really nice way to like kind of focus in and spend time, you know, being very introspective. But it also could be a very social sport. So
now you work at the Smithsonian. As you said, it's a very different job from rock climbing, mountain climbing. And I don't want to make any assumptions, but I feel like it's a safe job. Right. But when we think of rock climbing, that's being risk aware, which is probably two different sides of your personality. Did you grow up in DC?
I didn't. I grew up in Massachusetts and I was not sporty nor outdoorsy as a kid. And so becoming adult and taking up this like outdoor sport where you're, you know, getting dirty and spending a lot of time outside, like it's very, very different from my experience growing up. I think my parents are very surprised that I like to spend time, you know, outside and sitting on the dirt. And, you know, I was a little bit high maintenance as a kid, but, you know, I think I do find that in my job, of course, we do a lot of events. I spend a lot of time out and, you know, kind of running around the museum, out meeting people, putting on these massive festivals. But predominantly, I sit at a desk. And so, you know, being able to have something that I do after work that is very physical, that is very like problem solving, but in a very kind of different way. You know, I always kind of reflect on my career and up until I started rock climbing, I didn't really have a hobby that was so, so different. All of my hobbies involved going to museums, visiting galleries, you know, going to art openings. And while I do love all of those things, it was still very adjacent to my job. And so to have a hobby that is a 180 from what I do on a 9-to-5, I think was very, very good for my mental health.
Absolutely. What was your relationship with museums growing up? Did you go to museums often? Did your parents take you to museums?
I loved museums growing up. I grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts. And Worcester has actually a really incredible art museum locally. And my parents would send us to summer camps. We could choose what summer camp we wanted to go to. And so I chose to go to art camp at the Worcester Art Museum. And that was really, you know, kind of my first exposure to museums, to art, to, you know, the possibilities of having a profession in the arts. And, you know, I remember walking around the galleries and doing all kinds of arts and crafts, some of which my parents still have at their home. But, you know, I think in that sense, I was really, really lucky because museum careers were not really listed in that, like, you know, take a test and we'll, you know, tell you what your profession might be. And so I will say having that experience and then being able to travel and visit other museums in New York, in Europe, you know, that really kind of fueled my interest in art in museums. This is my first museum job, actually.
That's what I was going to say, because you went from running community arts program to the head of cultural programming at Apple. I mean, that's a cool job. I am not going to lie. When I saw this, I was like, oh my God, that sounds so cool. And then Smithsonian. So your trajectory is not linear and this is not your first job. What were you looking for in each move, especially what you were doing at Apple versus now at Smithsonian?
I think for me, when I'm looking at my own career trajectory, which when I look back on it, it's very confusing to have to kind of explain to someone, you know, how I ended up where I ended up. But for me, the basis of my thinking in each of these roles has been about community, has been about connecting artists to audience, to, you know, being able to create this space and this thinking around art, being able to translate the intention of artists to audiences. I think if you go back to my academic path, which was also very nonlinear. You know, I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I ended up in college and ended up studying art history, and then went into an exhibition design path. I think the piece of that from the very beginning was a real interest in how do we tell stories of artists, of art, of history, and make that accessible to audiences. So whether that was working with emerging contemporary artists to now, you know, working amidst this incredible collection of Asian and American art, and thinking about our museum, our collection, but also our intention to create that type of community space for people to gather and to really celebrate themselves.
Oh my gosh, Nicole, I have so many thoughts and so many questions. I was like saying this in my intro. First of all, not a big museum person. I get really anxious in big museums. And imagine I live in New York. So for me, my safe space, my happy medium is Guggenheim. You take me to Guggenheim, I'm happy. You take me to Met, I am anxious and lost. But when we talk about inclusivity at the museum, or, you know, creating this space where people can enjoy their art, when a visitor walks through a gallery, say, of South Asian, East Asian, Middle Eastern art in a Western museum, what are they being actually told, and what is being left out of those stories?
I think this is something that we think about a lot, and I'm sure that other institutions that hold Asian collections really think about a lot. And I can speak for us specifically. We're really, really interested in these types of object histories and how can we think about this object, how it got here, which tells us a lot about world history, about the history of art collecting, of taste making. And the way that sometimes, you know, we think about it is being very transparent about these stories will help people to kind of understand how all of this came to be here. So our museum was founded 103 years ago at this point, and it was is the product of a collector who was really passionate about Asian art. And our museum was really the first that was dedicated to Asian art here on the National Mall. And so, you know, to think about that story, that is really a gift to the United States to be able to bring this kind of education and this beauty to the US. But in the last 100 years, you know, there has been a lot of dialogue around how these objects have gotten here and why they're here behind glass or on a wall. And so we have these conversations quite often in the museum. We have a lot of relationships with entities across the globe, including in Cambodia, in India, and we have these conversations with them a lot about where these objects came from originally, how they got here, and if there is the ability to return them to, you know, where they belong in a safe manner and in a manner that is going to expand the knowledge and the intention of the artwork, then we have those conversations.
And you did that, right? Your museum recently returned sacred objects to both India and Cambodia.
We did.
Not because anyone filed a claim. It was something that you guys did. Most institutions don't do that. Why do you think you guys took that step?
We have a whole department on provenance research and object histories. And across the Smithsonian, this is a really big conversation. While this is not my lane of expertise as someone who does programming, it is a really important part of museum practice right now to be thinking about these issues of object histories. We are trying to be really good stewards of art and of culture and of, you know, the mission that we have at Smithsonian, which is around education.
Absolutely. That's so important. So I hear this argument a lot that museums talk about they preserved an object that may not have survived otherwise, right? You've talked about inclusivity. That's another piece of the puzzle. People talk about how you give accessibility to art. For instance, Asian communities here, African communities here can go and see the art, right? The origins of the art. My concern with that is twofold. Do you believe the argument that if these objects were not preserved, they would not survive otherwise? That's the first question that I have for you. And then the second part is about accessibility. Who are we catering to? Are we catering to the audience in the US? Because I'm pretty sure people who live in India or Cambodia, Pakistan, Egypt, they can't come here. It's not accessible to them all the time because there are travel costs associated. There are visa issues a lot of times. So it's not meant for them, right? So we are getting objects from those countries, from those regions, but people from those regions lose access. Who are we catering to? And the preservation argument, does it hold?
It's a case-by-case basis. It depends on the capacity of the field in particular places. I'll use a non-Asian example of something that has happened in the museum as well. We have a collection of objects from Yemen, and these were discovered to be looted from Yemen. There was a whole investigation involving various government officials. So the museum was tasked with evaluating these objects, with doing some of the conservation work. And then what was determined between the Smithsonian and the government of Yemen, as well as other organizations that are involved in issues like trafficking and looting, was that they are actually safer at this point in the U.S. at the Smithsonian, because if they had been returned to their home country, the likelihood that they would have been looted again was pretty high. And so we have this agreement with Yemen to safeguard these objects until it's deemed that they are able to be returned. And so I think it is really a case-by-case basis. We are doing, in Cambodia, for instance, a lot of capacity building work to train other museum professionals to think about the ways that objects can be preserved. And listen, there's a whole other conversation about like the intention of conservation in various cultures and various thinking. The Western Museum Standard has been a standard that has been brought around the globe. But I think what is really important in the conversation is that it is a conversation that we are not traveling to Cambodia and India and prescribing how standards should be approached based on cultural standards and the ways that these objects are viewed outside of the kind of Western gaze. Those kind of conversations are always ongoing. And to your point, when these objects are in their home country, many of them being sacred objects, and they are interacted with in a different way than they are here because they're seen in a different way. And so, you know, I can see, because this is such a fresh kind of conversation, I can really see, you know, in 5 and 10 years, having a much deeper dialogue between Western and non-Western museum practices.
Some people argue that museums in the West are a colonial institution. How do you debunk that?
I don't really think that it's something that we can debunk. You know, I think if you look at the history of museums, especially in nations that are older than the US, that kind of philosophy around collection and expansion and imperialism is baked into a lot of institutions. It's really about how do we move forward in the way that museums function and see themselves and serve the public, which is really, you know, at the end of the day, what we are all about. We're a public institution. And so being able to respond to things that audiences are really interested in. Also, we can't deny that over the last, you know, hundreds of years, this is the philosophy that we've come from.
Let's talk about the current philosophy then. How is it changing?
So for us in particular, and I think this is why in my role, we're really excited about the work that we're doing, is like we are not interested in seeing the museum as that stagnant place, you know, where things are under glass and kind of there for their aesthetic value. Like we are, I think, unique as a museum in that we're really interested in ways to bring communities into the museum, whether that's through conversation or through public programming, through festivals that we do, and to create that third space. I think in the very beginning, you said you like museums are a place that make you feel really uncomfortable, that you don't feel like you belong. We're trying to change some of that narrative because we do see, especially at our larger festivals, which are Lunar New Year, Diwali, Nowruz, we see a lot of first-time museum goers who, without this kind of program that is putting culture at the forefront, they wouldn't necessarily step through the threshold.
I want to go back to you because you said you loved being in museums growing up. What pulled you in? What was about museums that you enjoyed as a kid?
I just really thought it was fun to be in certain spaces, you know, and I think it was also a little bit of an escape. I grew up in a kind of a normal suburb in Massachusetts and, you know, kind of did like normal kid things, but the ability to go to a museum and see artwork from China, from Asia, from Korea, from medieval Europe, that really kind of helped it transported me to somewhere else. And, you know, it sparked, I think, a lot of curiosity in me about who made these artworks, what are they trying to say. From a really young age, like I've always loved painting. Being able to see a trajectory of painting that arguably was very Western focused, taking, you know, art history as a young person, but then being able to expand that to be able to kind of see these influences, these motifs, and how art is constantly influenced globally and how that itself is a reflection of world history. I wasn't necessarily super academic about it, but also, you know, I think just really curious.
Yeah, and with art, it's ironic, right? On the one hand, we think of art as this universal phenomenon, but at the same time, a lot of us try to find ourselves reflections of who we are, where we grew up, culture that we ascribe to in art, right? So when I go to the Met and if I see something from the Indus Valley Civilization, I connect with it because it just reminds me of where I come from and what I learned growing up. Did you see yourself reflected in art in these museums when you used to visit them? Do you see yourself now reflected in art that you see?
It's complicated, and I'll have to take it back a little bit. So I'm Korean American, and in the U.S., historically, there has not been a lot of Korean art represented, at least until the last, you know, decade or so. I'm also adopted. And so, you know, I think growing up, I was not really exposed to Korean culture, especially Korean art. My parents wanted me to like go to Korean culture camp, and they were had all of these like books about Korean culture and Korean stories. And I wasn't ready, and I was not as interested. I think I was much more interested in assimilating. And, you know, there's a whole kind of complication, right, about identity. I wasn't really until I was an adult that I started to be really interested in my own heritage. I think a lot of adoptees kind of have this sort of same like revelation at some points, you know, that there's pieces of culture that are missing, but we're always going to be in this in between. But I have felt in the last, you know, years that I have visited Korea and seen Korean art in various museums in Korea, but also here in the US. Actually, we just hosted at the museum a really incredible, massive exhibition of Korean artwork from the late Samsung chairman, from his collection that included a lot of Korean treasures. And being able to host that here in the museum was actually kind of an emotional experience for me because I get to step outside my door and see it every day, but also, you know, feeling this like sense of connection. There was not really like a logical reason for it because I hadn't seen a lot of these works before. I felt very proud that we were able to host this exhibition and programming related to it, but also I get to continue to have that kind of discovery about myself through art. And so, yeah, it's kind of a complicated answer to your question because, you know, I think growing up, I was oddly way more interested in like 19th century romantic paintings from Europe. But as an adult, being able to continually learn about Korean art, about Asian art more broadly, seeing these kind of connections between production and processes and materials and history, I feel like I'm learning a bit more about myself as well through this appreciation of Korean art.
What have you learned so far?
When you see Korean ceramics, for instance, there's very distinctive periods of Korean ceramics that represent different periods of Korean history. And in a lot of cases, the ways that these were produced and the way that they look is indicative of the values of the time. And so, you know, for me, getting to learn that about the history of Korea and Korean people and taking all the way to contemporary history where, you know, right now, colonialism and even more modern, the kind of history of why Korean adoption has been so prevalent among people that are, you know, my age who were adopted to Western countries in the 80s, you start to kind of have this story of the resilience of Korean people just overall throughout kind of modern history. And then to kind of take that to its like most current view where like Korean culture is everywhere, right? There's like the Korean wave has like taken over. And I have conversations with other Korean Americans, some adopted, some who are second generation, third generation. And to see this prevalence of Korean culture is incredible, right? We all love being able to have Korean food at a, you know, go to a really great Korean restaurant whenever we want to. But it is a little bit complicated, I think, especially for some of my friends and colleagues who are second generation immigrants. Like growing up, it was not cool to be Asian. And now it's K-pop and K-dramas are all over the, you know, the kind of popularity spectrum.
And to your point, I feel like America does this often, right? Celebrating a culture, but not the people. And we see that dichotomy exist. I was talking to a friend recently and we were like, you know, all of a sudden Ramzan has become very cool, especially in New York. During Ramzan, we were seeing iftars and we were seeing interesting posts and people coming together. But then are Muslims an accepted, respected minority? Not necessarily, right? So how do we make sure that when we celebrate certain cultures, we celebrate the originators and people who belong to those cultures? That's so important as well. We've talked about objects, we've talked about preservation. Sometimes I wonder, objects that may have been mundane, objects that may have just existed in other parts of the world, all of a sudden, we see them in this very revered form in museums. There's a story behind those objects, and there is a history that we get to read about. How do you see that transition and the stories that we are shown in a museum? Are we sometimes glorifying things to the extent where we just lose sight of reality in some ways? Does this make sense?
I think we as humans have always been interested in the material culture of societies that have come before us. And I think what you see in a museum now reflects that. I can use an example of another part of our collection that we have of Japanese teaware. And, you know, I think collectively, people in the US have this love of Japan and love of, I mean, especially right now, like tea culture. But in a lot of sense, you know, those were mundane, everyday objects, but they offer a glimpse into, you know, how people lived and how people existed, how they past time, how they drank tea. And so, you know, something that we do, we have a really special part of the collection where we can actually use some of these objects.
Interesting.
Annually, we get to host a tea presentation that is a traditional Japanese tea presentation, and I'm not going to go into all of the intricacies, but there are multiple tea schools that practice different types of tea ceremonies. And so we've gotten to bring various ones to the museum to present, you know, the traditional ways of whisking matcha and the different gestures and ceremony of it all. And so, you know, it's a bit of a crossover that you wouldn't think about when you go to a museum, that, oh, this object actually held tea and was used by, you know, someone in this type of ritual that was more common than we presented at the museum, because it is still a collection object and we're still handling it with really utmost care. But now I think people see some of the teaware in the collection, they're thinking about the action that it was a part of. Again, it's no longer this stagnant object under glass. It is something that was used. And there's other parts of collections that people can have that connection with. In our Korean galleries, we also have holders of liquid, so water jugs and cups. And in the Korean exhibition we hosted, we had writing utensils and ink wells. And so creating that visual story of someone utilizing this device. What we try to accomplish in galleries is connecting that to the way people do things in a modern way, right? Writing utensils that we currently use. How are they different? How are they similar? You know, teacups, they haven't really changed that much over the years. But, you know, I think in some sense also being able to explain why they look a certain way. And it's because of the access to material. Is it because of the way that they were created? Why don't they have a handle? You know, when did we start using handles on our teacups? And so, you know, I see some of the role that we play in the museum in public programs as bringing those objects to life and being able to tell those stories through programming and through activities.
And it makes a lot of sense. You're right. We are basically tracking human evolution, right? And that's always fascinating as to how people were living, you know, 200 years ago or 300 years ago or 500,000 years ago, right? And similarly, I'm sure this curiosity and mystique continues. It will continue way past our existence. And yes, museums become those places of exploration of who we were and who we've become. And that's always intriguing. Before I let you go, can you tell us a little bit about the Illuminasia Festival, which is happening at the Smithsonian this month? Just a brief overview of what the festival is all about and what people should expect.
You know, as part of our programming for the year, so like I said, we have these major festivals that we do. We have our biggest festival, which is Lunar New Year, which is bringing together many different cultures that celebrate the Lunar New Year, from Chinese New Year to Korean New Year to Tet. We have a Nowruz festival, which is for Persian New Year, which was really, really special. We also celebrate Chuseok, which is Korean Thanksgiving, which is another way that I have been able to personally connect to my own heritage and learn about the cultures and traditions. And so that brings me to this festival coming up in about a week or so, which is called Illuminasia. And it was also a festival that was launched in 2023, which happened to be our centennial, our 100th year anniversary, focusing really heavily on Asian Americans on AANHPI Heritage Month, was a really, really wonderful way to think about, you know, the mission of the museum as a place of connectivity around arts and culture and community and audience. The festival is really broadly based around Asian American storytelling, and we do this in a variety of ways. We focused on mental health and well-being 1 year. We have focused on poetry, on art and creative production. We've had film festivals, but this year we are launching our first ever book con. And it's a collaboration with the Asian American Book Club in New York and Third State Books, which is a bi-coastal publisher of AAPI literature. And so they're bringing the book con to DC for the first time. May 22nd and 23rd, we'll host a series of author talks, of panel discussions. We'll have a film screening / author talk / Bruce Lee DJ set film screening to really kind of talk about the kind of history of Asians in America through the lens of Bruce Lee's career and this love and appreciation of his work. I'm really excited because we have a keynote presentation by the Pew Research Center and Neil Ruiz there. He has been conducting decades of research on Asians and our trajectory here in the U.S. He'll be in conversation with Helen Zia, this legendary Chinese-American journalist. It's the 250th anniversary of the United States. It's the semi-quincentennial. And so, you know, for us, our ability to tell these stories, to think about the history of the U.S. through the lens of Asian immigration and kind of where we are, I think is really, really special to kind of address some of you know, how far we've come, but also how far we still have to go in the fabric of the United States.
That's such an important point, right? Because a lot of times when we look at festivals and events, it's all celebrations of, as you said, how far we've come. But the reality is not far enough. And I think having those difficult conversations is so important. And sometimes people, sure, those conversations are not palatable. People will probably switch in their seats and they will be uncomfortable. But having these big festivals also means a reconciliation of sorts, right? Where we are talking about what's actually happening. Asian identity is so expansive. How do we parse that out? What does it mean to be Asian in America? I'm South Asian, right? I identify as Asian. So I'm really excited for this. It's important to make people feel a little uncomfortable because you know what? That leads to self-reflection, introspection, and hopefully change.
It is definitely also a time to think about, you know, how far we still have to go and the types of conversations that can spark that dialogue. There's another panel with four really amazing Asian American writers, and part of it is about, you know, breaking down this model minority stereotype. And I am really excited about that one because, you know, I think in some sense there are still model minority is definitely one of the stereotypes, but, you know, and for them as women writers who write novels, who write young adults, who write children's books, you know, they are entering conversations with people having generalizations about them because of their identity. For them to be able to come to the stage and have this amazing conversation on kind of breaking down model minority myth as writers is something I'm looking forward to a lot.
Absolutely.
We're not monolithic, right? And I think that that's another like kind of double-edged sword of this month is it's how do we tell a wide range of stories without feeling like we're kind of all being lumped together as well.
Nicole, in the end, if you were to describe the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
I think the U.S. is a place of promise and opportunity and a lot of room for optimism, but also a lot of opportunity to open conversations. There's so much more work to be done, right? We're so young. 250 is so young.
So young.
For a nation. And so if we think about, you know, how we've come so far, right, in 250 years, but we have so much more work to be done to live up to the potential, right, of the diversity and the melting pot that we aspire to be.
And honestly, we don't even have to be a melting pot. We can be our own selves and yet feel like one. How can people find more information about the festival if they are in DC or if they want to go and, you know, check out the festival? Any links?
Yeah. So go to our website. It's asia.si.edu. Follow us on Instagram, which is NatAsianArt. We have a very lucky position on the National Mall. So if you come to the National Mall on May 23rd, you'll definitely see us right on the mall. We're having a dance party later that night, so the whole building will be illuminated. So,
oh, I love that.
It'll be really, really hard to miss us. The festival will be happening all day with authors, with children's books, with food. And, you know, we just hope that people can join us.
Thank you so much, Nicole. This was wonderful.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder how you guys feel about museums. As I said, I feel anxious, especially with museums like the Met. They're too big. You get lost in there. But you know what? Again, these spaces are important because they are a window into who we were and who we've become. And that's the fun part. As for the festival, do check it out if you are in DC or if you're visiting DC during that time. It's always fun to attend festivals, right? Anyways, this episode was written and produced by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week for another important conversation. Until then, stay tuned, check out our website, immigrantlypod.com. And if you want, you can follow me on Instagram @itssadiak.